Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shorty, bringing you the best of my time to show. You can listen to Politics Out the Boring Bits Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Coming up today, it's Wednesday, so it must be PMQs Unpacked. Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer go at it. Tim Shipman and I pause the action from the Commons, and then Lara Spirit watches the best of the rest. It's the last one for 4 weeks before they go off to party covers, but we'll find some other things to unpack in the meantime, I'm sure. So that's coming up in just a moment. But first, well, it's Wednesday, so it must be these two.
The Columnists with Ali Burt, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton on Times Radio.
And we say very good morning to Alice Thompson. Alice, how are you?
Morning.
You've bought me another Toblerone.
We have.
Does that mean you've been away?
Well, it was when I went away I felt guilty.
Did you?
Again, yeah. So I've got another one, because last time it went missing, do you remember?
I do. Well, that's very nice.
Great.
Maybe we could get them to sponsor the show. Shall I open it now?
Yeah,
should
we do that? We'll open it now and we'll talk about Ket. That seems the obvious the obvious thing to do on a Wednesday morning. You've written your column today about ketamine as the drug of choice amongst young people. I suspect it's a drug that lots of people who aren't young people aren't aware of its prevalence.
I think actually anyone over 25 doesn't know much about it, do they?
Yeah.
The problem is that it we're talking about laughing gas because you can see it, because you go to the park and you see the canisters. Yeah. And, you know, we think it's all about coke and heroin. We're terrified of that. But we don't talk about Ket because it is quite a modern drug. No, you know, children now are using it, but they weren't using it 25 years ago. And they are now using it for clubbing, but also because it calms them down, it relaxes them. If they're anxious, they're stressed. It's their drug of choice, and it's incredibly cheap. It's £3 a go. So
yeah,
that is the problem.
Yeah, that's the salient point, isn't it?
Mm. And easy to get.
Started life as a horse tranquilizer.
Yeah. That's what we always think of it as.
Yeah.
And they use the horse emoji when they buy it.
And do they?
Mm.
So
it
is
a Class B drug.
I did know about it because my kids are that age. I mean, not that they take it or have taken it, but they're aware of it being around, being offered at festivals and so forth. They make fun of it, actually. They talk about people in the K-hole who are just like, why would you do that? Because they're just sort of sitting there staring into space. I can't see how it... Why would it help you with clubbing? I mean, I can see why NDMA would help you with having a good time in a club.
It either G's you up, or not G's, that's a horse punter. But you know, drugs as a general rule, either
they're uppers or downers.
Uppers or downers,
and it's a massive, and by the sound of it,
it's a
massive downer. Clearly, if it knocks out a horse, it's a downer. So why would you then go to a club?
Yeah.
Because you get quite out of it on it, and I think that's what they're using it for. So,
okay.
I mean, but it's a huge problem, really, because actually it can make you incontinent, and it has a real problem.
Well, that's the thing, your column, you're right, this is not without side effects.
No, and the weirdest thing about it is that in tiny doses it can help with depression. So you get these headlines about Ket helping with depression, but in fact in any larger doses it's really bad for children's mental health, and we don't yet know what the long-term consequences are, but it can make you even more sort of anxious and paranoid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Elon Musk, in his normal, usual, responsible fashion, has said that he takes it. and it's better than SSRIs. Which is simply not true, because one's illegal and the others aren't, and Elon Musk isn't a doctor. So.
And the side effects of it are, you know, when you're talking about ending up incontinent, urinary tract
Prozac doesn't make you incontinent.
And then potentially long-term memory loss, panic attacks, psychosis. So what's the... Because politicians are always so funny about talking about drugs. They're either in the, we all need to, you know, chill out, guys, you know, we all had a youth, versus, you know, we need to crack down on these things. And neither of them really speak to the people who are actually taking it.
Yeah, well, particularly KET, which is Class B, so you shouldn't be taking it. But the police do the same, that they're not taking it as seriously as they'd be taking, say, Coke or some of the other drugs. It seems to bypass them. And also, you can't smell it, so it's not like when you're walking down the street, you actually get hit by a sort of waft of it. And I think it's very much a university drug as well, though it's now become a cost of living drug because it's so cheap.
So that's
another issue. So that it's permeated now far further. Yeah. And you've got that they put out alerts in Devon and in Suffolk as well as Yorkshire. So it's not just a city thing, this. It's going all around the country.
Is that a quarter of 16 to 24-year-olds said they tried it? Mm. I was quite really surprised by that.
Well, I can imagine you trying it once. I can't see a lot of them taking up. So only like about 3 or 4% take it regularly now, I think.
Yeah. It's very widely available in festivals and...
Yeah, loads of festivals. So Reading, that was their biggest drug of choice, really, at Reading.
I guess if it really makes you incontinent, then it will play itself out because people would rather not be
hearing those whole stories.
They would rather not be
incontinent. You were talking in your comment about somebody had a stoma bag as a result of taking it.
So that one of the hospitals said that had happened with, they didn't understand that one man had come in and then they realised that he was a regular user and it had completely messed up his bladder. So it can do that, but that's in extreme cases. Yeah. But I think that's what children should be told. So I think they need to know, because it's quite a bit, you can tell them it's illegal, you can tell them it's a Class B drug, but you need to tell them what the consequences are. And I don't think they're going to like that consequence at all.
No. Same with, a very full-strength skunk. Marijuana.
Yeah. Which again was sort of, it's so, so different.
Well, politicians get that wrong because they think, what's the harm in it? I had a bit of a blast of that stuff 20, 30 years ago. Yeah. And it's a completely re-engineered drug now and it's very serious because it caused permanent psychosis and brain damage.
One of the things that really surprised me over the summer when we went into Ailing between five cities was every other city we went to, you could just buy cannabis in shops.
Yeah.
And you just smelt it everywhere. And I thought, I hadn't really clocked that Europe had gone so much further than all of that. And how actually the fact there is no debate about doing that here in a way that, it's spreading across America state by state. It's clearly spreading across...
Even though it's widely available.
And in Amsterdam, they're going the other way now because I can see it.
Yes.
The problem is it is like 10 o'clock in the morning and if you're trying to get people back to work, that is quite problematic. And we've got enough of an issue here. Can you imagine if we had that as well, if you could pop in on the way to work?
But it's just interesting that we haven't even had that debate here about legalising it in shops and all that sort of stuff. Was you go, there's Amsterdam and then Budapest, Prague.
No, we're still struggling to prescribe it medically where there are benefits.
Proved
to be benefits with epilepsy and so forth,
Well, let's move on and talk about some other things we could ban while we're on the subject of banning things. 16 London councils are calling for a ban on outdoor smoking. Mm. Rishi Sunak's looking at a policy to ban disposable vapes. Tony Blair wants a tax junk food.
Yeah.
Are we turning into a nanny state?
No, I don't think so. I think this...
Would it be good if we did?
Well, yeah. Exactly. I mean, that's kind of what I meant to say.
Having just opened a Toblerone.
Yeah, I think this nanny state thing is a... I think Blair says it himself. It's a minority concern. It's a preserve of a few swivel-eyed libertarians in the Conservative Party, and they have been given far too much... credence and credibility. It's a good phrase, I suppose. That's part of it. Nanny state. Yeah. Not that most of us had nannies, and probably most of them did.
The ones who called it nanny state. But no,
government's there to try and create the conditions for a better life for the population.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It should do that. And it's obvious. I mean, I smoke, but I think this is a pretty good idea in terms of creating smoke-free pavements. If I need to be corralled into a smaller and smaller area, then that's the price you pay. I do think, smoking now amongst adults in Britain is down to about 13% of the population. It's a battle that's almost won.
Yeah.
You're left with a hardcore like me. I think the obesity issue is becoming a graver concern, actually, because we're now looking at what, 2/3 of adults obese or overweight. Yeah. And that might be so. Blair's tax thing is a more interest to me than.
I also think it's just harder now, isn't it? So if you take the food issue, you're being constantly pumped with food, so it's really hard. You can't not eat. It's not like smoking where you can just try and give up. You're going to have to eat, but you're being given this very, very highly processed food. So I think actually helping people with that, it's not like nanny said, it's just helping you to have some sort of control over your food rather than being pushed by these big food companies. Mm. And I feel the same with cigarettes. You've been pushed, that took a long time. And now we've got with vaping. Mm. I mean, it's fine to vape. And in some cases, the NHS want you to vape rather than smoke. But with the children, if you're using, 100 different flavours, that is definitely targeted towards younger people.
I mean, vaping's gone, it started out as a tool to get people off cigarettes. It then became something that 12-year-olds
And also those Elf bars are really, they're really bad for you.
I was with someone yesterday afternoon who was puffing away on a vape. And I said, you've never smoked. Well, how did this start? How has this happened? And is it now just a thing?
Yeah. And it is nicotine. So the problem is that people are waking up in the middle of the night. So, you know, you get children who've just got such a hit that they need to wake up at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
So have you been tempted by the vaping?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I probably should. I mean, I'm the sort of person who should be, but I haven't got around to it yet. I couldn't work them very well in terms of plugging them in and so forth.
They didn't have the right flavour for you.
It wasn't about, you know, it really wasn't about that. It was just about just pure habit and not wanting to stop smoking enough.
And is it, do you feel like a pariah now, being a smoker?
I don't feel like a pariah is putting it strongly. I feel like I'm in a very small minority because I am, especially in sort of middle class circles. Yeah. You're often pretty much the only person standing outside at a party or whatever. But I think that's fine. That's a sanction. It's bad for you. Yeah. And I've made that choice. It's a poor choice, but it's one that I've
made. So if these councils do to get it and they ban smoking outside, would that make you more likely to cut back on smoking or less likely to go to those places?
Both. I mean...
But then wouldn't you just be smoking in your garden the whole time?
Not necessarily, no. I think any pressure you can bring to bear is either financial or in terms of social sanction is fine, because it's plainly bad for people.
And it's that thing about creating friction, isn't it? It's being behind the counter. It's the, you know, having to ask a special debt, all that sort of stuff.
It's about having willpower as well. It's quite hard to have willpower for everything. So that you're constantly being pushed this stuff. Advertisers are constantly trying to get you to do stuff. And it's just helping you slightly not have that thrown in you the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, I've stopped drinking and I've lost weight. And then I need to address the smoking thing. And anything that can sort of make it more difficult for me to smoke, I guess, is a good thing.
Yeah.
But I think the obesity thing is becoming more of an issue. Yeah.
But I suppose how do you, because people can live without smoking.
Yeah.
But they can't.
Yeah. But then you tax it, don't you? So the problem is now that they've tried the sugar tax and it has worked, but they're just refusing to carry on with it because the big companies don't want you to do it.
Yeah.
The food companies really don't want it, and actually the supermarkets don't either.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people in government hide behind the whole nanny state philosophy when actually what they're subject to is lobbying from...
Lobbying, really heavy lobbying.
Coca Cola was one of the main ones, wasn't it? Whereas actually, Kentucky Fried Chicken did then cut down on its salt. Some of them behave better than others, but actually, they're the ones that need to be pushed, really.
And I repeat, I mean, politicians presumably go into politics to try and make life better for people. They don't have to tell people how to live, but they can create the conditions
and so much
in which
of
people
our
can live healthily.
What broader problems, whether it's depression, fitness to work, pressure on the NHS, comes from the health of the nation.
Yes.
The public health should be a massive thing. Not a sort of, you know,
well, it's kind of okay to talk about nanny state if you've got a personal trainer or if you've got, do you know what I mean, you can afford to go to the gym. It's all these things. Yeah. If you can afford to do it, then it's a lot easier. If you can't afford to do it, it's probably better to help have some kind of structure. So it's a ban or, you know, it makes it more expensive. So it gives you a nudge in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if that, see what happens. Before, I think just banning Robert Crampton would be better.
Me?
Yeah.
Why?
I think a council should officially announce you're banned. Or you're hanging around outside.
Oh, I see. With a cigarette.
It takes quite a long time to get outside.
It does from here, Yeah, that's the disincentive. Yeah, especially the way these lifts work.
You'd be the lift here to get down outside as well. Yeah, it's interesting. I want to ask you about Luis Rubiales, who, I mean, clearly this story's been rolling on. The Spanish Football Federation's now former president announcing at the weekend that he had resigned. But this is really interesting. In his interview, which was broadcast last night with Piers Morgan on Talk TV, he claimed cultural misunderstandings were behind the foray over him kissing Spain's World Cup winner, Jenny Hermoso, on the lips. Let's just take a listen to what he had to say.
I think Latin people, and it's a cultural question, have that tactile. It's pretty normal in a Latin world between guys and girls. Guys and guys, girls and girls. And it's just normal to that level of excitement and happiness that we felt during that final.
If the Spanish men's team had won the World Cup, would you have interacted with those men the same way? Would you have hugged and kissed them?
No tenga duda, 100%. No doubt about it, 100%.
Well, Jenny Hermoso's Spanish.
Yeah.
She's just filed a criminal complaint against him.
Yeah.
So she doesn't agree with the cultural...
I mean, if he'd kissed everyone, like the entire... If he just went around kissing everyone after the match,
yeah,
then maybe...
The point is, but holding your crotch like that beforehand, well, was that particularly... I mean, I don't know, but I also think he would not have kissed on the lips the men. He just wouldn't have done it, would he? So if you're not going to do it for the men, don't do it for the women.
It was non-consensual, that's the point. Yeah. Jenny did not... like it.
Yeah.
As she's made plain for the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Every time she's been sort of invited quietly to sort of shut up and go away, she's doubled down and said, no, I really don't like this, and to the point where she's taken him to court.
Yeah.
So he can't cite some cultural differences because she's Spanish as well.
And it's ridiculous. It was also just amazingly tin-eared on his part that if he had just said it
the
very beginning.
No, the man's got no dignity at all.
I'm an idiot. I got overexcited.
Yes.
Of course, I shouldn't have done it.
Yes.
She'd have said, I really didn't like it, but he's apologised. We've all done daft things.
Yeah.
Fine.
But the crotch grab, which Alice alluded to, I think suggests that the kind of man he actually is and why he didn't apologise and why that kiss is actually quite sinister. Because who does that? The kiss in itself, as a, you know, yes, could be excusable had the apology been forthcoming. Yeah. But the crotch grab, that's just weird. I mean, normal people don't do that sort of thing.
Well, they don't do it in public. And the other one,
they don't do it in
public. The kiss, it's the way that he holds her head. It's a real, he's grabbing her and she can't let go.
That's exactly right.
If it was just a kiss without that. But the idea that you pull someone towards you and force them into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It doesn't look good, does it?
And it's not, and it's patronising to the Spanish.
Yeah. It's never happened to me in Spain, I can tell you.
No, and to Latin people generally to say that.
Oh, you just don't understand. Yeah, because I mean, that's kissing everyone.
Yes, it's a very dangerous door to open, talking about, you know, kind of massive national stereotypes like that.
Yeah. And it just goes to show that actually he still doesn't really understand that it wasn't on.
No.
That's
correct.
The thing. Right, we're off to Dorset now, where the Tank Museum has become more popular than the Louvre and the British Museum on YouTube. It's had over 100 million views, which is a world first for a museum. So let's take a listen to one of its famous tank chats talking about the German Tiger II.
With the Tiger II, what we're looking at here is a vehicle that's done with a desire from Hitler. His desire in early 1943 is to see the massive L-71 Rheinmetall gun put onto a tank.
Yeah. So we can now go live to David Willey, curator of the Tank Museum. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Are you surprised by the huge popularity of the Tank Museum on YouTube?
No, because we're so good at it. No, I'm saying it's a bit of a joke, but no, from our point of view, obviously it's been a longish journey. So this hasn't happened overnight. We started quite early on and putting things on YouTube. We've got better at it. We've learned lots of different lessons. You have to follow the different formats. You have to pick up all sorts of different things that YouTube are changing the metrics or doing different things and everything. But it's what is surprising, I guess, is that there's not other subject areas out there that are quite matching us, and you thought there would be.
What is it about tanks and the military? Because look at your most popular videos, 2.7 million views, lots of them have got 2.5 million, 2 million. What is it about your tanks and your chatting about them that makes them so popular, do you think?
I think we are talking recently. We've been doing a fair bit on things like what's going on in the Ukraine, is the tank dead, all those sorts of stories. So we've tried to keep some of that topical. But I think in the longer run, there's a sort of desire for, one of the words used sometimes, authenticity. There's a lot on YouTube and out there, of course, which is fast, in your face, very ephemeral. If you look at some of our films we've done, they're quite, and I use this word, boring. They're for the nerd. A lot of detail. They're for, we know the audience we're aiming at. It's boring middle-aged blokes like myself.
And if you don't mind me saying so, Robert.
Yeah, I'm responsible for some of those 100 million views. I think the film, the Fury film, Brad Pitt might have had an influence as well. There was a tiger in that. Isn't the last surviving tiger at your, is that the one at your museum? Did you wheel that out for that film?
We did, the hero tank in it, Fury, with the Fury written on the barrel, is R. Sherman, so we've still got that in the collection here.
Yeah.
But it was that idea that you can go a bit more deeper, you can go on longer. Early days, I always remember we were being told, you know, you're 2 minutes, that was it, everyone's bored to tears after 2 minutes. We've got videos on there over an hour.
Yeah. But it's not true. I mean, look at TED Talks online.
Because originally, Alice, when people were talking about, you know, because you were watching it on your phone, people thought nothing more than 2 minutes. But actually now, with, you know, and also because you can get YouTube
you
on your telly.
You want the opposite now, don't you? You want the podcast that lasts. And actually, my husband does watch Tank YouTube.
Good
and
lad.
We have actually been past the museum, and he has been to the museum with two of our children.
Yeah.
The other two have rebelled, like me.
You excused yourself.
Yeah, I'm not. I am not as big into tanks, but he has read books like Panzer Commander books. I mean, he is obsessed. And I think it's a good hobby. It's quite an innocent hobby, I have to say.
Also, I mean, it's pretty important. I mean, the T-34, the Russian tank, pretty much won the Second World War. So, do you know what I mean?
It keeps Robert entertained for hours.
It's kind of...
keeps him off the streets. Yeah, David, exactly. What's your favourite tank?
I'm often asked that, and I always love dodging that one because, for me, it's not just the tanks, it's the stories behind them, i.e. the people that serve in them, etc. So we get this all the time. It's kind of, you know, what's your top one? If you had to do top five, what's the best one? Is it the one with the biggest gun, the thickest arm, or whatever? All tosh, of course, because the best tank, as we're seeing in the Ukraine at the moment, is the one with the best crew in it. Mm. And that's one of those things. So for me, it's also passing on the stories of... We've been very lucky at the place. We meet veterans. We've recorded people over time. So it's all those other elements to it. And also things like, you know, we've met the women who made them in World War II. That idea of if you've got someone, think of the Ukrainians again. That was Britain in 1940, 41. You know, it was women in the factories making something they thought might bring my husband, my brother, my father, my boyfriend home quicker if it's better and if it works. So there's emotional stories and real resonances, I would argue, with lots of these things. Sure. But the truth is we're still doing it in a way, you know, it's we're trying it in different formats. We're doing shorts. We've got other people. It's not just boring middle-aged guys like me doing it. But it's working. That's the point. It does, you know, and you have to keep an eye on how it's doing, but it's also making the effort to do it. And for us, that was a big one, was in lockdown, where we'd already built up an audience. We tried to keep going. I was doing it from a back garden. Most people were more interested in my dog wandering around than what I was saying. But it really helped us at the museum.
Well,
you know,
congratulations, David. It is brilliant. I suppose it's one of those things as well where you wouldn't get it on BBC One on a Friday night because I think it was too niche. But actually, if you've got a global platform, then your niche can still be pretty big. David, really, really good to speak to you. David Woodley there, curator of the Tank Museum. And if you just want more tank content, there is, in fact, an interview with David Woodley about the Tank Museum on the Times Radio YouTube channel as part of our Frontline series. So you can go online and have a look at that.
Fantastic.
Anyway, that's your afternoon sorting, Robert.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Alice, you can be excused.
I think Robert's going to go off to the museum, aren't you? You're going to try and get that.
Yeah, I'm going to try and get down to Dorset this week. Yeah.
We'll pop in and see Alice on the way back.
Yeah, she's here.
You come in a tank.
Devil's beyond Dorset.
Park it on the front lawn,
Robert Crant and Alice Thompson there, and you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's PMQ's Unpacked.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley and Tim Shipman.
Yes, Tim Shipman, the Sunday Times chief political commentator, is here.
Hello, Matthew.
You return from your summer break. You're here for 2 weeks, and then we've got another break coming up.
Well, it's not a break, though, is it? It's more of a sort of punishment escapade where we go and listen to politicians.
So there was a four-week party conference recess.
Yeah, and there's only really three, four weeks of...
Well, there's nothing on next week.
No.
And then we've got the Lib Dem conference, which finishes on the Tuesday.
Some of us may or may not be going to
that. Well, we're going because we're off to Bournemouth because the sun's going to be out. They've got a good crazy golf course. And then the following week is the Conservative Party conference.
Yes.
Lasts till Wednesday. And then the Labour Party conference technically lasts till Wednesday. But
and for the geeks, this is very exciting because the order has switched. I know. For the first time in a very long time.
Which is because of a booking mishap?
I believe so.
The venue in Liverpool wasn't available.
But it is normally the case that the Prime Minister, who obviously has the power to sort of set the agenda a little bit more than the Leader of the Opposition, normally gets to go last.
Yeah.
And however good a conference the opposition has, that it's still sort of on the racket for the Prime Minister. That won't be the case this time. And that may sort of slightly subconsciously reinforce the idea that, you know, Labour is the more interesting of the two conferences.
I suppose the flip side is, I assume we'll get lots of government announcements at the conference, and actually the question then to Labour is like, well, what are you going to do about that? What's your plan? They're actually hiding as... I mean, we had John Healey on the show earlier in the week and asked him about defence, and he said the army was too small and he'd stop the cuts. So, OK, how big should it be? I'm not going to get into that now. How would you pay for it? Well, there's still to come. And you do wonder whether that line is going to be very hard to hold when you've got dozens, hundreds of journalists from around the world turning up and asking the question, what are you going to do and how are you going to pay for it?
Yes, and that's the challenge for them, isn't it? But equally, looking like a government in waiting can often involve looking like you're not going to tell anybody anything.
Yeah.
Which is good practice for being in government as well.
Well, we'll see how all that pans out. Lots of you saying hello on the YouTube channel. Hello from Farnham in Surrey. Well, it's not far from me. Good afternoon from the sofa. Hello from Derbyshire, said David. Hello from Cardiff. Hello from Norway. Phil says, I'm only here because I saw the retweet from Kate McCann. Thank you, Kate McCann, for doing that. Somebody's in Tamworth. Now, it's interesting, the Tories have chosen a new candidate in Tamworth, haven't they? Because they had a slight problem.
They had another issue with their, you know, it was one of those. Chris Pincher, who was effectively driven out under Boris Johnson for allegedly misbehaving in the Carlton Club in the evenings. So, yes, it's going to be another by-election with what ought to be a stonking great Tory majority that won't be because the incumbent has been driven out in disgrace and this is not a government that's doing terribly well in by-elections at the best of times.
So I think we can go to... Can we go live to the House of Commons now? Yeah, OK, here we go. Then this is question number one, then, the last one for several weeks. This is Keir Starmer. Oh, we don't have Keir Starmer yet. I don't know what he's doing. Keir Starmer is wearing his sheaf of wheat. It is Back British Farmers Day. And he's wearing a sheaf of wheat. Doesn't
They're
look
not
like
subtle, these sheaves of wheat,
it doesn't
are they?
Look like Rishi Sunak is wearing his sheaf of wheat.
Oh.
Or indeed anyone on the government bench, I don't think.
I wonder what the North Yorkshire farmers would make of that. To be honest, if Rishi Sunak wore a sheaf of wheat the same size as Keir Starmer's, it would probably...
Might knock him over.
Yeah, it'd be leaning to the side, at least.
No, just looking on the Tory benches, there's Suella Braverman's now on the front bench. Secretary, she's not got one. Alistair Jack's not got one. Alex Chalk's not got one. Oh, it's going to be a fun game, isn't it? Do join us on the Times Radio YouTube channel. Who's wearing a sheaf of wheat? Let's go live to the House of Commons. It's Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I join the Prime Minister in his words about the Clerk of the House? Mr. Speaker, I pay tribute to the police who tracked down the escaped terror suspect from Wandsworth Prison last week. Yeah. Despite being charged with terrorism and despite being a flight risk, he was not held in a Category A prison. Why not?
Hey, Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to thank the police and their partners for their efforts to find and arrest Daniel Caliph.
There is now an ongoing legal process that must be allowed to take its course. But I'd like to reassure the public that while these cases are extremely rare, the Justice Secretary has launched an internal investigation about how this could happen, as well as an independent investigation of the incident, so that we can learn the lessons from this case and make sure that it never happens again. Yes.
An interesting decision to go on this, given it is now very much a live criminal case, as Rishi Sunak
pointed out. Yes,
pointing out.
And Starmer has some experience of understanding the perils of prejudicing.
If he's mentioned it before, he was a former director of public trials. Prosecutions.
Yes, but one wonders now then if there's going to be a bit of a sort of security theme. Are we going to hear about spies as well as the day goes on? Terror suspects. Ben Wallace was the former Defence Secretary on the front page of, I think, The Telegraph this morning, wasn't he, saying, the European Convention on Human Rights is stopping us tackling terrorists. I don't know if that's got anything to do with this. I suspect it probably hasn't. It's probably more cock-up.
Yeah.
But
also, it depends. I mean, I wouldn't have said there's a huge political advantage from you know, rightly or wrongly, because it does sound like it's a nightmare in prisons, but the general public normally don't mind what's going on in prisons. But whether or not he can wrap this into a broader argument about nothing working.
Well, I suspect it will be that, and just the government kind of just cock-up after cock-up, I suspect, is where we'll be going. And
for those who were with the title of the podcast sorted.
For those who were with us last week, whoever is holding Suella Braverman's string is again nodding her head most vigorously.
Yes, so somebody pointed out that it looks like someone pulls a string at random points, which makes Suella Braverman nod, sort of basically unrelated to what's being said. Well, let's go back to the House of Commons then. Is Keir Starmer going to stick with prisons, or will he go elsewhere? It's question number two.
The truth is they're presiding over mayhem in the criminal justice system. Only a few short months ago, Zara Alina's family said ministers had, and this is their words, blood on their hands after probation failures that led to her murder. So it beggars belief that we're back here once again. The Chief Inspector of Prisons said conditions in Wandsworth are so bad it should be shut down. The Chancellor is telling anyone who'll listen that he raised concerns months ago. Yeah. Probation, school buildings, now prisons. Why does the Prime Minister keep ignoring the warnings until it's too late?
Yeah. Prime Minister!
Mr Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman with his background should know better that it, because of the wide variety and considerable difference in severity of people charged under that act, it is not and has never been the policy that they are all held in Category A prisons, something that I shouldn't need me to point out to him given his experience. But he talked about resourcing. I am happy to tell him that over the last few years, we have delivered an extra 4,000 new prison officers. Staffing levels at Wandsworth in particular are up by 25% in the past 6 years. And because we're boosting prison pay, we're also improving retention and at the same time investing £100 million to improve prison security with new measures like X-ray body scanners. But if he wanted to have a truly honest debate about this, perhaps he'd acknowledge that prison escapes under the Labour government were almost 10 times higher than under the Conservatives.
Right, so
I'll see your politics and I'll give you some facts.
I'll give you, yeah. So Keir Starmer sort of hinting at that. He talked about probation and then school buildings and now he's on to prisons and the general sense that people who've warned these services are struggling, they need more money, and that Rishi Sunak, when he was Chancellor, didn't give them more money. And now we are seeing the consequences of that.
He also claimed Jeremy Hunt had said they need more money. Jeremy Hunt looked slightly perplexed by that. He was shaking his head and going, what are you on about?
I thought Jeremy Hunt did say that he'd raised concerns about Wandsworth. I think he said he had a constituent. He said he raised the alarm over extremely worrying conditions and staff problems at Wandsworth months before.
Well, that's what that will be about.
Yeah. Then. He passed a detailed set of allegations about the state of the prison and lack standard staff to Wandsworth governor. After failing to get a reply, the allegations made by a constituent, there we are, he was on remand there for 8 months. After failing to get a reply to his submission, he escalated it to the then prisons minister, Damien Hines, and the prison service headquarters in June, but only finally received a response last month. So I think that came out a couple of days ago.
I think the other significant thing there here, though, is that Starmer's now trying to run an argument against Sunak that he gets all these warnings and he takes an age to do anything. So Starmer's done quite well at saying Sunak's out of touch and doesn't do the right things. He's now trying to run an argument that because he's so in the weeds and studies everything for inordinate lengths of time, that he doesn't act on it. And I think there was a report in one of the papers this morning that on the alleged spy in Parliament, that Sunak was told about that back in the spring and then continued to do his kind of rapprochement stuff with China. So I wonder whether we're going to hear about that sometime
soon.
There's
also the argument that Sunak tries to mount in response is everything is totally fine and has been and is better than it was under Labour. And that is, but that's also why we're spending more money on stepping up security.
Yes, it's sort of security so good that it requires another £100 million and another 4,000 prison officers.
Yeah. Which again is quite a hard sell.
I mean, if we're having an honest debate about politics, you could say if Labour get in next time, a year into a Labour government, lots of people are going to discover that it wasn't just the wicked Tories. Yeah. A lot of this is quite complicated. There isn't much money and you do have to make choices and priorities. But right now, this is a political game. And for the most part, there's quite a lot for Starmer to go at. Though I thought Sunak probably, you know, that was a pretty robust response. And the line about escapes being 10 times higher was very well received by the people behind him. So, he's holding his own.
Some decent research done by number 10.
But as ever, in six questions, it's quite easy for the leader of the opposition to slot a couple into the goal.
And to try out some of the arguments, I suspect we will hear a lot of at those party conferences. Let's go back to the House of Commons now, though. This is question number 3 from Keir Starmer.
And it will continue this week. Who wants to start this session by leaving? Please do so. I'm happy to help you on your way. Keir Starmer.
Big sheaf of wheat.
Every week, whatever the topic, he paints this picture as if everything is great and fine out there. It's so at odds with the lived experience in the real world. Let me turn to another serious security concern. Some in this house face sanction, intimidation, and threats from the Chinese state. When I asked the Prime Minister on Monday whether the Foreign Secretary raised the specific issue of the alleged spy arrested in March when he visited China a few weeks ago, the Prime Minister would only say that he raised that type of activity, but avoided specifics. So I asked the Prime Minister again, did the Foreign Secretary raise this specific case when he visited China, yes or no?
Mr. Speaker, I'll refer to the Honourable Gentleman to my previous answer, where I said very clearly that the Foreign Secretary raised these issues with the Chinese Foreign Minister who he met, as did I when I had my meeting with Premier Li over the weekend. But when it comes to China, Mr. Speaker, this government has put in place the most robust policy that has existed ever in our country's foreign policy. It is to protect our country, to protect our country for the values and the interests that we stand up for. It is to align our approach with our closest allies, including those in the G7 and the Five Eyes, and is to engage where it makes sense, either to advance our interests or, as I did at the weekend, to raise our very significant concerns. That is the right approach to China. It is one that is welcomed by each and every single one of our allies, and I'd be interested to know what he thinks that he would do differently.
So moving on to China. I mean, again, Rishi Sunak saying the most robust policy that's ever existed.
Look, is it robust in the sense that they've thought about it and calibrated a position and written it down? Yes. Is it robust in terms of being tough? I don't think it's as tough as Liz Truss was running when she was, however briefly, our Prime Minister, or even the bog end of the Boris Johnson regime. And the Conservative Party has veered between the sort of George Osborne approach of we need to be friends and make lots of money doing business with them and a more sort of pious view about human rights and all the rest of it. But the problem you've got here is that, if this chap has done what he is thought to have done, then, that heats at the very heart of the sort of democratic process. And that is kind of a big deal. And Sunak's quite good at sort of saying it's more important to sort of, you know, and saying it's the most robust thing ever. You know, I mean, I remember.
I mean, given that ministers openly on the radio often can't explain, is China a threat? Is it a challenge? They get in a muddle. I think Alex Chalk, the Justice Secretary, did it the weekend.
Yeah.
They're actually, you know, it is nuanced.
They basically say it's, you know, they are a commercial rival and a security threat, but they're not an enemy in the way that Russia behaves.
Russia, yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's the distinction they try to run. And the bottom line is the Russian economy is about the size of, you know, the economy of London.
And China
if that,
is it, yes.
And China is many times the size of ours, you know, if, yeah. you know... Well, it's not many times the size, but it is bigger than ours and it's getting bigger. And, you know, people talk about the Chinese century. Not having a view about China is not an option, whereas with Russia you can sort of cauterise it and see them as a sort of largely negative
and
force.
And be confident, with the exception, obviously, of North Korea today, most of the countries are going to follow suit on that.
Yeah, I mean, I did enjoy that, though. I mean, the idea of Putin drawing on, you know, Kim as a sort of character witness I found deeply amusing.
Not sure that necessarily plays around the world. We are going to deduct points from Keir Starmer because he has used the phrase lived experience again.
Again.
He did it last week. I just do not think the Prime Minister gets how it's all fine out there. Is at odds with the lived experience of millions of people? June the 21st, I'm sure that from the vantage point of his helicopter, everything might look fine, but that is not the lived experience of those on the ground.
I mean, it's, you know, it's a phrase that tells us something important, but it... You know, one would have thought Starmer's aides would have found a more sort of straightforward way of saying that.
Yeah.
It's not how people talk in the Dog and Duck.
No, it's how people talk on Twitter about identifying as a vegan. Right, let's go back to the House of Commons now. This is question number four from Keir Starmer.
Well, that certainly wasn't a yes. And what he says now is totally at odds with the Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee report of July this year. That set out that the government has no clear strategy when it comes to China, has failed to support the intelligence agencies, and is leaving the UK severely handicapped in managing our future security. This has been raised time and time again. But yet again, the Prime Minister fails to heed the warnings and is now desperately playing catch-up. So will he finally commit to the full audit of UK-China relations, which so many in this House have so long demanded?
Minister, Mr. Speaker, as always, the Leader of the Opposition is just playing catch-up and hasn't caught up with the reality of what's actually happening. He talks about the ISE report. Again, if he actually went through it, he would realise that it related to a period of investigations which was in 2019 and 2020. Since then, Mr. Speaker, we have launched a whole new integrated review refresh of our China strategy. It's published. We've put in place a range of new measures, including, for example, the National Security Protective Agency, which is staffed out of MI5, supporting businesses and organisations and being alert to the risk from cyber and from China. But if he wants to talk about foreign policy, Mr. Speaker, he should perhaps reflect on his own record, because this was the man who said he was 100% behind the former Labour leader, a person who wanted to abolish the army, scrap Trident, and withdraw from NATO. It's clear what he did. He put his own political interests ahead of Britain's.
Yeah. A little bit of the bell there. Jeremy Corbyn throwback.
True, but on this subject, I think he's got a point.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, on two things, people who like Keir Starmer, but remember those times, are prepared to be quite critical of him. One, that he didn't do nearly enough on anti-Semitism when Jeremy Corbyn was allowing that to run through the Labour Party. And the second is that, you know, Corbyn is the most out there leader that we've had in pushing a century in terms of foreign policy. He fundamentally, you know, sided with a lot of overseas nations against his own. And Starmer, again, you know, was happy to prop him up. So on this, I think it's more legitimate than on a lot of the stuff that where the Tories throw that at them. But that was all quite substantive, wasn't it? Quite how sexy it is for the public. I mean, you know, the previous answer, Sunak was talking about, you know, this robust policy. Well, now, you know, it's the integrated review refresh.
Refresh.
Which is what I was referring to. I should have spelt that out as well. But it took you know, there's not people sitting around going, well, it's wonderful that you've got this.
But then it's interesting, Luke, that Keir Starmer talking about, and I know he's asked about this before, a few months ago, a full audit of UK-China relations. And, you know, whether it is people who are working in Parliament, whether it's, you know, we were talking on this about this on the show earlier, universities and the way that they're entangled in both the number of Chinese students and the fact that universities rely on them for money, but also research as well.
Well, and the other question is that British, you know, public schools, which if they do lose their charitable status under Labour, it would probably be only Russians and Chinese that can afford to go to them.
And then you end up even more entangled. And then you say, well, we can't do anything because of the economic dependency.
I mean, a cynic would say that, you know, a full audit is a very good way of not bothering to have a policy for 2 years while you allow the audit to unfold. You know, these are complicated questions that do not lend themselves to you know, punchy questions and glib answers.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, but I would be interested to know what Labour's policy is on China, and I'll be honest, I'm none the wiser as a result of these exchanges.
It's a full audit in addition to the integrated review refresh. Come on, Tim, pay attention. Let's go back to the House of Commons now. This is Keir Starmer, question number five.
Probation, prison, schools, China. Yet again, inaction man fails to heed the warnings and then blames everyone else for the consequences. Mr. Speaker, on Sunday, the Home Secretary celebrated her first anniversary in post. That is, if you overlook the 6 day she missed when she was deemed a national security risk. In that year, 40,000 people have crossed the Channel on a small boat, and the taxpayer is now spending £6 million a day on hotel bills. He's failing to stop terrorists strolling out of prison, failing to guard Britain against hostile actors. He's completely failing to stop the boats. How can anyone trust him to protect the country?
Well, Mr. Speaker, he talks about trust. He talks about action. Just today, this government is taking action to reform defective EU laws to unlock over 100,000 homes, boosting our economy, supporting jobs, and ensuring that we can realise the aspirations of homeowners. Now, he talks about trust in this House to talk the talk on house building. But at the first sign of a cheap political hit, what did he do? He's caved in, Mr. Speaker. Rather than make the right long-term decisions for the country, he's taken the easy way out. It is typical of the principles-free, conviction-free type of leadership that he offers. Flip-flopping from being a builder to a blocker, Mr. Speaker, the British public can't trust a word he says.
Wow. So, so Keir Starmer trying to tie it all together on probation, prisons, schools, China. How can anyone trust him to protect the country? And I suspect this is born out of, and we've heard it a little bit in some of the focus groups as well, that one of the strengths of Rishi Sunak does have is, with some voters at least, or a bit of purchase, this sort of boring technocrat possibly doing the right thing because he could be off earning money elsewhere if he didn't, you know, if he wasn't doing this.
Yeah, and this is going to be his big argument at the general election, that, you know, I'm making decisions for the long term, even if I don't benefit from them politically, I'm doing the right thing for the country. That's going to be his big argument. The flip side of that is that it takes him a long time to do things, and they don't always bear immediate fruit. And I thought Inaction Man's
that, quite good.
Well, it got a laugh and a sort of nervous tittery, quite a sort of, oh, that's good. There was a sort of, I'd be very surprised if we don't hear quite a lot of
Inaction Man. Yeah. Oh, God, it's going to be the thing they all repeat at party conference, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like it's the first time. Every single
speech will have a shadow minister like explaining why he's failed.
Because he mentioned Jeremy Corbyn earlier. There was a year when every single Tory minister mentioned Venezuela, made a joke about and being Caracas. And there was quite a lot of hoops that you had to jump through to get from Jeremy Corbyn to Caracas. But anyway.
And then Sunak's response,
yes,
which was he didn't even bother to, you know, no pretense of answering that question. He hit him with this stuff which we talked about a couple of weeks ago about
nutrient neutrality
and how that makes it very, very difficult to build homes, and the government's changed on it. You know, and Sunak's right, Starmer did bring this up quite a lot. You know, we had two or three sessions on housing, didn't we? And, you know, that will be their argument. You know, you give them a chance to support something sensible and they don't do it. You know,
the response to that would be, well, we're the opposition, you know, we're not here to make your life easy.
And actually, it's long been one of those things that you get the sense that the government doesn't seem sufficiently gripped by the salience of the rivers issue. The all the Lib Dems seem to talk about is sewage and rivers because it clearly has a purchase.
I've got a friend on a WhatsApp group who you know well, who never shuts up about it. It's poop in the rivers, poop in the seas. It's like the centre of his life.
Well, because it's really easy to understand.
Yes, it is.
It's dirty, you know. It's a powerful image.
Quite. And if you want to say the country's gone to shit,
well, there it is.
There we go.
And it's so the idea that the government, the idea that Rishi Sunak thinks the right policy to pursue right now is one that leads to more stuff ending up in rivers. Whatever the arguments in favour of house building, that's a hard sell.
It's a hard sell, but it's also it's one of those decisions that, you know, if you're serious about trying to get things done, maybe there's an argument for it.
Yeah.
And this is politics. It's all about trade-offs. And what it is then about, if you're the person making those decisions, is explaining them clearly, rather than using them as a punchline in PMQs, where most people listening who aren't having the benefit of pausing and having, you know, listening to us two, who has a clue what he's talking about? They're just sitting there thinking, well, he's not answering the question. I mean, the point he's making is sort of interesting and legitimate. But it's not very good politics the way, you know, I mean, he could have been a little bit more explicit about it.
Well, let's go back and find out. So we've had Inaction Man. We're yet to have a Captain Hindsight.
Does he have a better line than Inaction Man?
Let's find out. Let's go back to the House of Commons. This is question number 6 from Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, every week he comes here protesting that nothing's his fault, trying to convince anyone who's still listening that everything is great. The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
Mr. Speaker, we are getting on for the British public. Just in the last week, announcing a new landmark deal for British scientists, attracting £600 million of new investment for our world-leading auto industry, and wages now rising at the fastest rate on record, Mr. Speaker. And where has he been this week? Locked away with Labour's union paymasters, promising to give them more power and scrap the laws that protect British families and their access to public services. It's clear it's only the Conservatives that are on the side of the hard-working British public.
Oh, no Captain Hindsight.
No, there was quite a bit of, I mean,
Knockabout.
There
was a phrase that
I did find myself switching
slightly off switching off. Well, I was about to say, Keir Starmer used the phrase, anyone still listening?
Yeah.
And
We're here, Keir.
We are, don't worry, we're here still. But still listening to Rishi Sunak, and that's definitely something that's come up in some of the polling and some of the focus groups that we've done, is that there was a poll this week in the Times that you were saying that more than half of voters would never consider voting Conservative. That there's a risk that it doesn't matter how much Rishi Sunak goes on about boasting that he's rejoined Horizon, that we only left because of the Brexit that he advocated. People aren't listening anymore, and that is a real concern in Number 10.
Totally.
That the shutters have come down. Well, they're not really listening to Keir Starmer either, I think it has to be said. But
Look, politics is very changeable. Anyone who's covered the last seven years of British politics knows that what seems to be the case now may not be the case in 6 months' time.
Yeah.
I've spoken to Tories who say, well, you know, the kind of stuff that Joe Biden was talking about before the last presidential election, by the time he got to the election, it all completely disappeared. But it does, those of us that have been around a little while, and you kind of think you get a feel for things. And it felt like, you know, the bog end of Boris Johnson and the Truss episode was a total disaster for the Conservatives and put a lot of people off completely the end. People then wanted to listen to Rishi Sunak. They thought, he looks like a serious bloke. He's getting his head down. He's grinding away. We'll see whether he's making a success of it.
And to a degree, he hopes to be judged ultimately by whether he can tick the boxes that he claimed he was going to tick. And those are still very much a work in progress. And but there's a slight sense that in the kind of middle of this year, that people began to take the view that he wasn't really cutting through. He wasn't terribly exciting. The guy, you know, is all very well being a boring technocrat, but if you're not getting the job done and everything still seems to be rubbish, and there's just a sort of sense that the worm has turned and that, you know, the desire for change, you know, you talk to Tories, they acknowledge that. The only way they can sort of say that they might have a chance is by saying they'll make him the change. Yeah. And he's going to stand up, we're told, at conference and make a whole series of promises about how he will, you know, he will be different from other politicians. And, you know, that's part of the argument we've been talking about, that, you know, he will do everything for the long term. He's not in it for himself, blah, 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 blah. But it's a heck of a thing to take a change agenda after, you know, 13 years from an opposition which is riding high. And, you know, the interesting thing about Starmer, which I'm planning to explore in a piece quite soon, is that, you know, this is a guy who hated politics. He didn't like it, found it all quite trivial. He's got quite good at it.
Yeah.
Now, it's not all his own doing. He's hired some good people. But that's the main skill of being a leader is having
some good people around you.
So, you know, it feels a bit like Sunak is really pushing water uphill right now.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's been watching. I see a little bit of Toblerone.
Beautiful British product. Well done, the British farmers.
Well, the British farmers of Switzerland.
I'm happy to staple that to my shirt, if you like.
It was delicious. Yeah, Alice Thompson bought it in earlier because she went on holiday. She bought us a big Toblerone. There we are. Lovely. That's the sort of content you're missing if you're not watching along on the YouTube channel. Lara Spirit's here.
Hello.
Redbox editor. You've been watching the best of the rest so that we don't have to. Overall, the mood?
MPs are pretty lively, I would say, but very surprising, I think, to see it really dominated by the pensions triple lock. A number of questions to this effect from a number of people who thought it was in their interest to ask it, and I'm not necessarily sure that it was. But I'll fly to one first, which is, as I always do, Stephen Flynn.
Yes!
We'll listen to both. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Such unique enthusiasm. This is him asking about the state pension. It's very interesting. He focuses both of his questions on it, and I think, given the news today, it's worth listening with a keen ear.
Well, because anyone who wants the state pension triple lock to continue will be hoping that the Prime Minister is going to commit to it in full.
Yeah, and he's going to commit to not tinkering with it, as the Times reported this morning, by an estimated £600 million potentially. So have a look to see if Rishi Sunak makes that sterling commitment here.
Yeah. Mr. Speaker, as someone who spends more money heating their swimming pool than the total value of the UK state pension, I think it's safe to say that the Prime Minister might not be as invested in this topic as some others, but let's afford him the opportunity to clear up any confusion. Will he commit his party, the Conservative Party, to maintaining the state pension triple lock beyond the next general election? Yes or no?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this is the party that introduced the triple lock, Mr. Speaker. This is the party that has delivered a £3,000 increase in the state pension since 2010. It's also the parties that ensure that there are 200,000 fewer pensioners living in poverty today, and this winter ensuring that pensioners get an extra £300 alongside their winter fuel payment to support them through the challenging times with inflation. So, Mr. Speaker, our track record is clear. There is one party in this House that has always stood up for our pensioners, and that is the Conservative Party.
Well, let's have a listen, because I think Stephen Flynn, did he have another go on this?
He has another go on this, yeah.
Well, let's have a listen, see if he has any more success. It was notable. He didn't fully commit what she's seen out there. So let's have a listen to Stephen Flynn having another go.
I had a yes there. And you'll imagine my shock, my utter surprise, that we appear to have consensus once again between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party on this most important of issues, despite the promises that were made to the people of Scotland in 2014, and despite the clear statements from the likes of Gordon Brown that the only way to protect your pension is to remain within the UK. How hollow those words are now. So may I ask the Prime Minister, who does he think will scrap the state pension triple lock first? His government or the Labour Party's government?
Clarkson.
Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I said, thanks to the actions of this government, pensioners in Scotland are receiving record increases in their state pension, £870 this year, extra support with the cost of living this winter. This is the government that introduced and remains committed to the triple lock. But he does raise a good point, Mr Speaker. Pensioners in Scotland should know the reason they can rely on the state pension, not just today, but for years to come, because of the strength of our union and the strength of our United Kingdom government.
Very notable lack of full-throated commitment.
Yeah, we sit here listening to what people say. Quite often it's much more important what they don't say. And it would be very strange if he committed to it, because we don't know how much money there's going to be. And it costs an absolute blooming fortune. And
is this a slight exercise in kite flying, do you think, of just keep letting it get out that you might not do it and just gauge the reaction? If there's a huge sort of Theresa May social care style backlash on the doorsteps, then you might step back from it.
And you say you were always committed to it.
You're always committed to it.
But and then you get a win for doing what you were always doing.
Yeah, and I think there are two separate issues here, because there's the issue about what happens in response to the news about wage growth yesterday and what to do in the immediate term about the fact that they might not want to raise the state pension by as much as would be expected. And then there's the issue about whether or not you recommit to it in a manifesto, right? And those are two things that I think are being kind of willfully lumped together to create a sense of ambiguity. It was interesting listening to Finn there, because of course he singled out Labour as well on this. And I think given recent polling showing that Labour's making a really significant comeback north of the border, it's unsurprising that he keeps going on this. And this is something we're seeing more and more in PMQs, that he wants to paint the Conservative Party with the same brush as the Labour Party, because both he sees as a threat to them.
And actually, yeah, using his two questions to sort of lump them together and attack Starmer as much as Sunak is evidence of that. Well, that's probably quite enough, Stephen Flynn. What else have you got for
I'm
us?
I'm afraid it's not quite enough, pensions triple lock. So we're going to go now to Ashley Dalton, a Labour MP, a pretty new Labour MP, who of course took over from Rosie Cooper, and she is making a similar point around the triple lock, which is ever so slightly confusing, given that actually, and you'll hear Rishi Sunak say this, there is some ambiguity around the Labour position on that too.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I thank the Prime Minister for his answer to the Honourable Member for Aberdeen South, but I'm still confused on this matter, because just yesterday the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions said that the pensions triple lock is not sustainable. The Chancellor's economic advisers have suggested that it is time to review the policy, but Number 10, when questioned, have said they're committed to it. So, Mr Speaker, which is it?
Mr Speaker, this government is committed to the triple lock. It was this government that introduced the triple lock. And she might want to have a word with her own deputy leader, who I don't think provided much clarity on the matter. And remember, Mr Speaker, I think we all remember when it came to pensions, what we can remember is Gordon Brown's 75p a week increase.
Oh, that's one from the archives. Tim, when was that?
Yeah, it was a while ago. I remember the Daily Mail put a picture of a packet of peanuts on their front page, which cost 75p.
And that was sort of why the Tory Party, 1999.
And at the risk of trivialising, the people with the string on Suella Braverman's head are now pulling it side to side, and she's shaking her head at the appalling behaviour of Gordon Brown.
Whereas Mel Stride, the working pension secretary, who's been talking about the pension triple lock, is trying to look incredibly serious while wearing an enormous sheaf of wheat on his jacket. Interested in that question coming from a Labour MP, given that the Labour Party is very reluctant to commit to this either.
Yeah, and this is likely, if the polls are to be believed, to actually be more of a problem for the Labour Party than it would for others. I saw a former cabinet minister earlier who just said, "I don't know why we don't just commit to it outright, because they think we're going to win, they're going to lose the election," and just obviously create a very big early headache for the Labour Party in doing so. So I'm not sure that was a massively well-advised question, though. Maybe she knows something that we don't.
Frankly, there are more Tory votes. You know, traditionally speaking, pensioners vote Conservative, and it's more important for the Tory party to shore that up ahead of an election, whereas Labour doesn't get nearly so many pensioners.
So
they can afford to sort of say to everybody else, why should we give all this money to pensioners?
Laura, where are we going next?
We're going away from the state pension, you might be pleased to hear, and towards Luton Airport.
I don't think anyone's ever happy to go to Waterloo Airport.
Well, increasing numbers probably will be, according to Daisy Cooper, who asked this question about the expansion of Luton, which you might think sounds boring, but actually
no,
I think
don't introduce it like that. You've got to say it's really exciting. It's Daisy Cooper, who's the deputy leader of the Lib Dems, talking about Luton Airport.
She's talking about it, and she is giving Rishi Sunak an opportunity to clarify his position on net zero. So take a listen to this.
Great.
Luton Airport is trying to massively expand its airport capacity from 18 million passengers per year to a whopping 32 million passengers per year. This will blight the lives of thousands of residents across Hertfordshire and Bedfordshire, and especially in North St Albans, who live under the flight path. But it will also fly in the face of the advice from the government's own climate advisers. It's been reported that the Prime Minister is getting ready to ignore his climate advisers. Is that true?
Prime Minister. No, Mr Speaker, but what I would say is my approach to getting to net zero is not one that requires people to give up doing the things that they want to do and enjoying, like flying. The right thing to be doing is, as we are, investing in new technologies and funding them, things like sustainable aviation fuel, because that's how we'll decarbonise aviation on the transition to net zero, not force people to give everything up.
She didn't talk about blighting the lives of the 32 million people who are going to have to travel to Luton Airport every year. Get on that infernal shuttle bus.
I don't think I've ever been to Luton Airport.
It's so awful.
Campari, that's what I was thinking of. There's another cultural reference for you, you've got to get, Lava. This was a TV ad starring Lorraine Chase, where she said something about Luton Airport.
Yeah, well, there's an episode of One Foot in the Grave called In Luton Airport, No One Can Hear You Scream as
yes.
well.
Yes, there we are. Daisy Cooper wearing an enormous three-pronged sheaf of wheat.
Do we think it's bigger than everybody else's?
Are they free to fashion their own sheafs? Or?
Well, because Jim Shannon was sitting behind her, and he had his like stuck in his pocket, with it only peeking out like a handkerchief.
That's sweet.
Mm. Yeah. There we are. Are we all done then, Lara?
Yeah, I think. I've got more for you if you want them, but no, look, it really looks like you don't, so we'll stop.
I think you've probably peaked with Luton Airport.
I've got this to you.
You will be in people's inboxes at
3 p.m.
3 o'clock with the PMQ's Unpacked email. Oh, bit of gossip for you. You can put this in your email. Pat, there's been a ding dong between Alan Mack and Rupert Huck in the gallery. My eyes in the gallery say Rupert Huck has brought in her sister. Rupert Huck's a Labour MP. She's brought in her sister, Connie Huck, off of Blue Peter,
of
who is married to Charlie Brooker, and they're all in the gallery, and Alan Mack wouldn't move along the row, and they've had a bit of a ding-dong in the gallery, apparently, so that Charlie Brooker could watch PMQs.
I wonder what they made of it. That will go in the email. Thank you.
Good. Look forward
to what anyone makes of Alan Mack. God bless him. He's a sort of low-level national treasure, isn't he, Alan Mack?
In so many ways. So many ways. Well, that's all we've got time for on today's podcast. Thanks to Tim Shipman and to Lara Spirit for PMQ's Unpacked. That'll be back in, 5 weeks' time? But don't worry, over the coming weeks, we'll have plenty of coverage of the Lib Dem and Conservative and Labour Party conference. And we're going to be live at the Cheltenham Literature Festival as well. If you want to come and see us live, just go to the Cheltenham Literature Festival website, search Matt Chorley, and you can come and watch us live on Friday, the 13th of October. Get your tickets now. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, is goodbye.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.